born on the Nativity of Our Blessed Mother and celebrating 10 years on the air, The Winds of Change.
Marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is wrought. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my pleasure to be sitting in, as I do on Mondays, for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. Well, it was quite a weekend. I don't know about any of you, but sometime shortly midway through our family Friday night pizza, my phone started to ring and ring and ring, and I thought, good heavens, what happened? And turned on my phone to see that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had sadly succumbed to her long battle with metastatic pancreatic cancer and had passed away. And of course, leaving very little time to mourn, I think, for many people, jumping into speculation right away. Well, I didn't think that was quite appropriate to do, so I made some comments about what I thought was her beautiful friendship, which I think is part of her legacy with Justice Antonin Scalia. And I think the differences that the two of them had on pretty much everything that had to do with the law and its interpretation did not impede their ability to have a true and genuine friendship. And I was very much surprised, actually, to see a post from someone, a friend of a friend, who used to live in Justice Scalia's parish out in Arlington, Virginia, who said he actually saw one time Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at Eucharistic Adoration with Antonin Scalia, and that she really did seem to be taking all of it in very seriously and seemed to be quite, you know, recollect as she sat there. So, you know, we pray for the repose of her soul. We do not agree, certainly, as Catholic Christians, with many of the positions that she took, especially regarding the redefinition of marriage and the killing of unborn children, the private legal killing of unborn children. We strenuously disagreed with her on that. However, early in her career, she did have some, you know, good decisions and some very interesting ways of helping women to be recognized equally as members in society for things, you know, for example, things like, you know, women being able to hold a mortgage without a male co-signing it, things like that. So hard to believe that that actually once was the law in many states, but it was. But enough of my opinion. I have asked, and we are so privileged to be joined by my friend, Professor Carter Sneed, who is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame in Notre Dame, Indiana. He is also the center director for the De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture. And Professor Sneed, thank you for being with us again. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Mary. It's great to be with you. So happy to be able to join you this morning.
Yeah, I imagine you, like many law professors, especially someone with as high a profile as you have, were receiving all sorts of questions and inquiries about, you know, everything that may happen, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later in the segment here. But what's your kind of, just as an attorney, someone who teaches the law, you know, what has your overall impression been of Justice Ginsburg's legal legacy, maybe kind of putting aside for the moment, you know, her abortion and marriage decisions, which, of course, I do think created a lot of damage and will continue to societally. But what about some of the other things about which she felt passionate and wrote about? Do you have any kind of reflections on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd like to, wholeheartedly agree with you that the important thing for us, I mean, obviously we're all political animals and people, and we have an election coming up, and people are very much focused on that, and our country is in a unique moment of polarization and anxiety, and so it's natural to immediately move to the practical political consequences of human events, but it really is important to do exactly what you said, which is to say to stop for a second and think, this is a real human being with real loved ones who has passed away and battled cancer and had friendships and family, and we should really be thoughtful and mindful about that and to pray for the repose of her soul and for her loved ones and take a beat before we immediately launch into all of the logistics, consequences, and retrospectives on her legacy. So I completely agree with everything that you said at the outset, and I think it's admirable for you to set that example for all of us, because it's easy to get caught up in the moment. But, I mean, Justice Ginsburg was an extraordinary figure, an extraordinarily impactful figure in the law. I mean, she was a very dedicated progressive, of course, and was, served in nonprofits like the ACLU and was a pioneering figure for equal rights for women in that context, and was passionate about women's rights as a justice as well, focusing on, violence against women, employment discrimination, how to, what the proper standard of review is for laws and policies that burden women uniquely in the workplace and elsewhere. And so I think that she's, she was a passionate advocate for those things about which she believed. And then as a judge and justice, that clearly translated into her jurisprudence. Her jurisprudence focused on, all the goods and norms that she believed in as an advocate, made their way into her jurisprudence. And so she was, a pretty standard person of the left in terms of her approach to the Constitution. She was not an originalist. She was not a strict constructionist. She allowed her policy preferences to inform her decision making based on her understanding of what her job as a justice was and what the Constitution is, and those are propositions that I think people do and can disagree with strongly. But she was a faithful adherent to her own framework, and in her person, she obviously was an important figure, showing that women could be just as successful as men at the very highest levels of the legal profession, and broke a lot of barriers and cleared the way for a lot of women to come after her, including women who disagree strongly with her jurisprudence and her normative point of view. I mean, there's a sense in which we should think about the connection between Justice Ginsburg and the wonderful judges and other women who are being spoken about in the media now about her potentially taking her seat. I mean, even though they believe very different things, have a very different approach to judging, I think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg did blaze a trail of sorts for women of all kinds to flourish in the legal profession.
Right, and especially, there was one of her earlier cases I was reading just to get ready for the show today. It was a decision she wrote regarding a man whose wife was a school teacher for many years and was widowed. She passed away, very sadly, I think she might have been in her 50s, and the local school board or whoever was managing her pension that she had paid into, the entire time they were married, he was denied the right to inherit her pension and had left behind children, that this man needed to care for. And she, really had some very beautiful things to say about the raising of children in the context of a family, includes the father and the father's role. And so, I don't know how I square that with her later abortion decisions. And, the last oral argument I heard was in the Little Sisters of the Poor case. I listened to the entire thing, and I believe she heard those arguments and participated from her hospital bed, which I just, I mean, the sheer force of will that woman must have had, as ill as she was, it appears, in these final few months, to still be able to, hear oral arguments, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I was a little bit surprised. I mean this with no disrespect. It almost sounded like kind of a set of talking points she had been given by Planned Parenthood or NARAL or something. They were so sort of, perfunctorily pro-abortion without really trying to probe behind why the little sisters would object to what they were being asked to do.
Yeah. I have to say, obviously, it's impossible in talking about Justice Ginsburg, despite all of her virtues and despite of her, admirable friendship with people that disagreed with her and her commitment to friendship. And she really was, in many respects, or at least seemed to me, I didn't know Justice Ginsburg, to be very kind of, in many respects, not all, to kind of rely on common sense in a way that is unusual and certainly different from modern liberals and progressives who are coming up into, through the courts and through legal academia. She's kind of old-fashioned in those ways, but it's really not possible to talk about, and this is the kind of heartbreaking tragedy of it all, of Justice Ginsburg and the great gifts that she had and the great powers of intellect and force of will she had, is that she just had this blind spot, and it was worse than a blind spot. She was very badly mistaken and confused about fundamental questions involving the unborn child and the Constitution and believed that the Constitution forbade any meaningful protection of unborn children in the womb, which is not a serious interpretation of the Constitution, right. Not a serious interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
Right.
On that she was very badly mistaken. And I have to say, as much as I admire her in for the reasons that we've already mentioned, I can't go along fully with the retrospective of her legacy, to say the least, regarding women's equality, because she really did believe and acted accordingly that women's equality depended upon
right.
the permanent subpersonal status of the unborn child and the right to kill unborn children.
Correct.
And that's something that you can't, paper over. I know everybody's excited, that's the wrong word. Everyone is moved to remember her fondly but unfortunately one of the grounds in which people are reflecting is her work on equality for women and we saw that opinion where she chastised Justice Thomas for referring to women who had abortion as mothers using the word mother. We've seen where she, every oral argument in which the question of abortion arose, she would repeat the undemonstrated proposition and thus false proposition that childbirth is more dangerous than abortion, which has
right.
never
which has
been demonstrated epidemiologically.
It's been disproven. I think not just comprehensively, but very compellingly disproven.
Yeah, there's a great article by Byron Calhoun that shows that the basis on which that claim is made is completely indefensible. It's mixing incommensurable qualities, using incomplete data, overt double counting maternal deaths, both deaths from abortion and deaths from that are associated with pregnancy. If you read this, it's in the Lineker Quarterly from 2013 by Byron Calhoun, a physician from West Virginia University. It's a devastating critique of the proposition, and it's not surprising. Justice Blackmun just says it in the in Roe v. Wade. Of course, there was no evidentiary hearing in Roe v. Wade. Roe v.
Right.
Wade was I don't mean to get into the weeds for your listeners, but that decision, there was never a trial in Roe v. Wade to test the evidentiary proposals by the adversarial process.
Right,
so,
and to interview experts in law and in embryology in particular about what this unborn child looks like and may feel and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, or the history of abortion in America and at common law, and whether or not abortion was a crime at common law, whether it was a crime in the United States, what the laws were at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment. If you dig into the story of Roe, it's unbelievable that Justice Blackmun relied on a law review article written by the general counsel of NARAL for all of those historical points.
I know, it's astounding to me, first of all, just how few people really understand what the holding in Roe was. They don't understand that it means abortion for all 9 months for any reason. They don't understand that it permits sex selection abortions. And, when you even bring that up, they act like, you're walking around with some sort of tinfoil hat on. But it's all there and it's all factual. And unfortunately, when people like, candidate Joe Biden and Kamala Harris say they're going to codify Roe in the national law. They're going to make it a federal codified law. I don't think that people have the foggiest idea what that means in terms of where it's going to place the United States among other Western and civilized nations in terms of our abortion law and policy. So, well, Professor Snead, we're going to go to our first break. We'll be right back. I hope you can stay with us over the other end of the break for another couple of minutes. Wonderful, Professor.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, terrific. This is Mary Helen Fiorito speaking with Notre Dame Law Professor Carter Snead here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. Don't go away.
All right, pets, pipe down. I've got something to say to you. Yes, that means you too. Please tell your owners that Father Anthony would like to bless all of you on Saturday, October 3rd at 9 a.m. in front of the outside cross in front of St. Stan's. And if it rains, under the school portico or the St. Francis of Assisi Blessing of the Animals. St. Stan's is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. The Blessing of the Animals, Saturday, October 3rd at 9 a.m. at St. Stanislaus Kostka, two blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. And the goldfish are welcome too.
The Winds of Change.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church. And a security person will be on site to register and to participate in the Holy Mass. And for more information, go to ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change, and I am joined this segment by Professor Carter Snead, who is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame and also the director of the Notre Dame Center for Ethics and Culture, the DeNicola Center, and who is an expert on, among other things, abortion law and policy. And Professor Snead, I know in this new book that you have out, you actually devote an entire chapter to abortion and its history, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show today, because you're so knowledgeable about the topic. Can you just describe a little bit for listeners about that chapter and then tell us a little bit more about your book?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking about it. So the book is titled What It Means to Be Human, The Case for the Body in Public Bioethics, and it's being published by Harvard University Press, released on October 13th, but available for purchase now on Amazon. And the book is overall an account of the three vital conflicts of public bioethics: abortion, assisted reproduction, and end-of-life decision-making, including assisted suicide. And the argument the book makes is that because all law aims to promote and protect the flourishing of persons, all law has at least an unstated premise about what and who a person is and what human flourishing is. And I take that insight and I ask the question of what does the law of abortion in America assume a person to be and what human flourishing is, not just in the sense of when life begins, but also in evaluating the maternal-child relationship, what a mother is, what a father is, what a community is. And I take a look at the jurisprudence of abortion, starting with Roe and working all the way through present day, and ask the question, what is the unspoken assumption about what a person is? And what I show in the book is that it's a kind of radical, reductive, individualistic view of the person that takes people to be really coextensive with and defined solely by their desires and their will, and their flourishing is defined as pursuing, the dreams and plans and destinies of their own invention by interrogating the interior of their selves. And if you read the jurisprudence of abortion, you see that that's really what animates it, and that's what animated Justice Ginsburg as well. I mean, the proposition is in the law, and it's a false and I would even argue wicked proposition, that there has to be a right to abortion so that women can unburden themselves from their relationship with their offspring in utero and pursue their dreams of their own invention. And Justice Ginsburg said to participate, you know, fully in the economic and social life of the nation as a woman desires to do, she has to have recourse to abortion, to choose choose sexual behaviors that are equal to those of men.
Right.
If a woman is to have maximal sexual freedom, she has to have access to abortion as a means of obtaining that freedom.
What case did she say that in, Professor?
She says that in quite a few cases, but the most important place
yeah.
she says it is in the dissent in Gonzalez versus Carhart in 2007.
Okay.
In that case, you will remember, was the partial birth abortion case, the federal partial birth abortion law, in which the justices decided in a 5-4 decision that the federal partial birth abortion ban of 2003 was, in fact, constitutional, even though it lacked an exception for a woman's health, because there were other abortion procedures at the same gestational stage that would be equally safe for the mother, of course not safe at all for the unborn child.
Right.
And Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, set forth the proposition, you know, so if we back up, Roe v. Wade is, you know, written by a man, you know, in an all-male court, and it was about privacy. And then in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, Justice Kennedy rewrites, along with Justices O'Connor and Souter, rewrite the rationale for abortion as liberty, freedom.
Right.
But then, this is what's so upsetting about Justice Ginsburg's legacy involving equality, is that in the dissent in Gonzalez versus Carhart, Justice Ginsburg lays out the case for the proposition that abortion, the right to abortion, is about equality.
Mm-hmm.
It's about women's equality, and it's a mechanism, an indispensable mechanism of them pursuing their self-invented destiny. It's not even about, abortion or pregnancies that result from rape or other forcible circumstances. She's talking about contraceptive failure and the choice of women to get an abortion so that they can live the same kind of lifestyle that men can, but not be unequally burdened by pregnancy.
Right.
And so it's a sort of rejection of the body. It's a rejection of the natural relationship between mother and child. And it conceives of that relationship as a kind of conflict between atomized individual strangers, one of whom is a person and one of whom is less than a person. And that is, and that completely and directly conflicts with lived human reality, in which the reality of parenthood, in which mother and child and father, for that matter, and community are all inextricably interconnected because of their mutual vulnerability and embodiment.
Right. And you know, it's so interesting. I wonder if that mindset, and that, you know, she seemed to cling so tenaciously to that particular viewpoint, you know, that as the old Feminist for Life, you know, button I used to wear, said, women don't have to kill to be equal. That we have to be able to do this, to have this private ability to dispatch our unborn children if we're going to be equal. And I wonder if this comes from, you know, the serious and significant prejudice she faced as a young law student and then later as a young lawyer, where she really did have to overcome tremendous hurdles to be taken seriously as a scholar and to be taken seriously as a lawyer. So I do wonder if maybe it was just sort of those early experiences, you know, in her career that perhaps helped her to form that judgment. And the other thing that's so odd about it is so antithetical to what all the early feminists thought. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Alice Paul. I mean, they all wrote about abortion as being a man's solution to a woman's problem. And that no country or no legal system that actually valued women would want abortion to be available to them.
No, that's right. And at the DeNicholas Center for Ethics and Culture, we have the Vita Institute, which is a kind of an intensive course for leaders of the pro-life movement and passionate grassroots organizers for the pro-life movement. You've participated in it. You've
mm-hmm.
taught in it.
Yes.
And one of we just had a virtual version of it at ethicscenter.nd.edu this summer. People can log on and watch the videos. And there's an amazing video by our wonderful colleague Jeff Keating about the history of feminism and abortion. And it's exactly what you just said. It's really arresting when you hear the early feminists and early feminist philosophers talking about abortion as a tool of male oppression,
mm-hmm.
a kind of way to further instrumentalize and abuse women for the benefit of men.
Yeah.
And it's I think you're very charitable and humane and correct reading of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's biography points us in an interesting direction that as accomplished as she had to fight to overcome, sexism and mm-hmm. and probably anti-Semitism and probably all kinds of different
right.
terrible prejudices to achieve what she did. And one can imagine thinking that, obviously if a woman's to be fully equal in every respect, she has to have the right to kill, to guarantee that freedom. And again, as I say in the book, the right to abortion is the perfect freedom for a world of strife of atomized individual wills. Like
right.
when you think of the universe as just isolated individual wills who are seeking their own destinies, sometimes they can collaborate with each other, but a lot of times they meet as adversaries and there's a conflict. And in abortion, we see a vital conflict, and the tool of annihilating your unborn child makes a kind of deadly logic and makes sense within a deadly logical framework of the anthropology that it reflects.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know now you have that wonderful chapter, which for listeners, for any of you who really do want to know a little bit more about the abortion issue in depth, it's going to be coming up a lot in the next 6 weeks. And so it might be good for you to have really more sophisticated talking points that you might already have. And so, Professor, other than the abortion, the abortion embodiment issue that you discuss in your book, can you give us just a quick overview of some of the other things you touch upon, and then let our listeners know how they can get a copy of it? Because I know it's not released yet, but you can get it early now on Amazon.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. My friends who have ordered it on Amazon have received their copies. So, you can just go ahead and order on Amazon, even though it says October
13th. And the title of the book again, please?
The title of the book is What It Means to Be Human: The Case for the Body in Public Bioethics. And again, the argument fundamentally is that the laws in these vital conflicts rest on a false anthropology. They rest on the proposition that we are merely disembodied wills who are seeking our own advantage, rather than embodied, mutually dependent, vulnerable individuals who require on networks of what Alistair McIntyre calls networks of uncalculated giving and graceful receiving in order to survive and flourish. And to put it the most concisely, I argue in the book that because of our embodiment, human beings are made for love and friendship. And I explore that theme in the context of assisted reproductive technology. And I focus on the absence of law. Basically, it's an accurate description to say that in America, you have the freedom to make a baby almost by any means necessary, and that leaves behind the intrinsic connection between mother and child and rearing family, and it's, whereas assisted reproductive technology fractured into all of its
right.
constituent pieces, the parts of human procreation, the law assumes, that basically what assisted reproduction is for people to pursue their own dreams rather than to become a parent, which means you have a child, and which means that there's an intrinsic relationship with unchosen obligations and unearned privileges. And so I focused on, I analyzed the area of assisted reproduction, and then I also turned to the question of end-of-life decision-making, both for people who have lost their capacity to choose for themselves, who are dependent upon life-sustaining measures, as well as the context of assisted suicide, where, again, what the law offers is the right to self-annihilation, whereas the right to abortion allows you the right to kill your unborn child to pursue your destiny as you see fit. Assisted suicide offers you the right to annihilate yourself in the face of your declining body and declining health.
Okay. I tell you, those are going to be very, very important topics as, again, this, I think not just up until November 3rd, but afterwards, sort of depending on what's happening. And I like that you take such a granular look at these sort of issues, because they have to be examined that way, I think, for people to fully understand them. But we're getting to the end of our first half hour, and I know you have to go teach. But before you go do that, Professor, I have to ask you the question about Judge Amy Coney Barrett. I'm sure you have as much inside knowledge as anybody does, but you've worked with her. She was your former colleague at Notre Dame. I was so distressed to see some really awful things being said about her in the media, that she's part of a cult and that she's sort of driven and has other people in this cult tell her what to do. Can you talk about her a little bit, just as how you know her personally and professionally?
Yeah. So Amy Barrett has been a dear friend of mine for 15 years since I joined the faculty here. She's still my colleague. She still teaches here at Notre Dame.
Oh, that's right. She does. Sorry.
And she and her family are some of the most extraordinary people I've ever met in my entire life. When you meet Amy, you can't really understand how she's capable of achieving everything that she does at the level that she does. She's an amazing mom. She's a wonderful friend. She's an extraordinary judge. She's a great scholar. And she does it all with a joyfulness and a kindness that really you have to see to believe. I mean, in a world where everyone is driven by their own ambitions and trying to accomplish, you know, whatever it is that they're aiming at, they can become selfish and they can become self-absorbed. And I've never met anyone more giving and more humble and more wonderful than Amy Barrett.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody said about her, and it's really true, that Amy Barrett is always the smartest person in the room, and she's always the most humble person in the room.
Yeah.
Which is almost an unbelievable
combination.
And so she's an amazing, amazing judge, amazing person. All this nonsense about people of praise, which is a ecumenical labor renewal movement, to which she is a member. I mean, they run schools. They run schools in D.C. They run schools here in South Bend. They run a school in River Ridge. They're amazing schools, classical education. They're wonderful people. They're the nicest, most generous people you could imagine. There's nothing weird about it. There's nothing, the Knights of Columbus are weird.
Correct,
And it's just unfortunate that the secular world, you know, sees people who, you know, believe and have faith and configure their lives accordingly, and they're scandalized by that. But there's nothing more normal than the people of praise. And for those Catholics who would ask questions, I'd say there's no better guarantee of their legitimacy than Pope Francis, who made Bishop Peter Smith, the bishop, auxiliary bishop, you'd know better than I would,
mm-hmm.
auxiliary bishop in Portland. I mean,
right.
the Holy Father would not take a weird cult and make one of their members a bishop.
And who helped to draw up their initial statutes was Cardinal George. Because so I think there's just the people in Europe understand lay movements far better than Americans do, because we're such an individualized society where people are independent, and so groups like the Focolare or Communion and Liberation or the People of Praise in Europe, it's not at all unusual for families to belong to these kind of cohesive groups that they pray together, they engage, as you mentioned, in corporal works of mercy, they serve the poor, they serve others, but they also serve as sort of a small faith community. And, you know, if anything, I think that's a great, you know, benefit to Justice Barrett, or Judge Barrett, I'm getting ahead of myself, And I do hope that those kinds of religiously bigoted questions and comments are not going to be directed towards her in the same way Kamala Harris tried to paint the Knights of Columbus, for example, during a Senate hearing to a judge because he belonged to the Knights of Columbus, and asking things like, were you aware this was an anti-choice organization when you joined them? I mean,
yeah,
you wanted
right,
to.
The Knights of Columbus. Right.
The people who see, you know, are sell the Tootsie Rolls on the corner and do your parish pancake
right.
breakfast, right?
Right?
So that they can bring warm coats. Like, you know, our local council does this thing where they buy, you know, winter coats for poor children through the money that they raise at the pancake breakfast. This is apparently a nefarious and threatening group
right.
now.
As
America becomes.
They wear weird yeah. hats, too, sometimes.
That's true.
Yeah.
They do.
Sometimes they
do.
Wear strange hats.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think springs from, it used to be that every major newspaper in the United States had a religion reporter, and the religion reporter was very well schooled in different religions, their traditions, the different nuances of religious worship and practice. And virtually every newspaper in the country, I can think of maybe only two, still have a dedicated religion reporter. And so when stories like this are being reported on, you know, you've got somebody who was covering, a car accident yesterday is going to be covering an in-depth analysis of the People of Praise the next day, you know. So people with only, you know, a cursory knowledge, maybe even of Catholicism, to be writing things about something they know nothing about, I find very infuriating. So, you know, listeners, I would also encourage you, you know, as we're told to in Scripture, be ready to give an explanation of the faith that you have and why it motivates you. And do you have a sense of who else might be on that short list? I know Amy Coney Barrett's the one everyone is talking about, but are there other names, Professor, that you know and that you're familiar with?
I'm sorry, you mean those under consideration
correct.
Right now for the
yes.
court?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've heard names. I think everybody's heard the same names. Judge
right.
Lagoa from the 11th Circuit, Judge Rushing from the 4th Circuit, Kate Todd from the White House itself. But I don't know any of them, so I can't really speak to their They sure seem impressive based on their accomplishments,
but
I don't know any of them personally.
Martha Packold and I went to the same high school. She went to St. Ignatius, and she is also on the board of directors there now, and she is a very devout, serious Catholic, and was valedictorian at St. Ignatius, which mm-hmm. is no small feat. And then she clerked for Justice Thomas of course, was Phi Beta Kappa, went to the University of Chicago, you know, has an academic, resume a mile long, but also a very, very serious, devout Catholic. So I was almost afraid to mention her name here because I think she's kind of a sleeper candidate that the media may not have done very much research on, whereas Amy Barrett, I think there are, you know, torpedoes lined up at facing her house, I think, at this point.
Right,
but
right,
I know
exactly.
somebody, well, you know, we have mutual friends who know her, who said she was at your local grocery store in South Bend and was sure that there was a reporter following her while she was doing a grocery shop. Can you imagine, you know? Anyway, well, Professor...
Well, it reminds me, remember Judge Bork, they went to the Blockbuster video and hoping to, you know, asking them what kind of movies he rented. And it turned out he rented like Disney movies, and they were disappointed that he wasn't renting the Blockbuster video.
No, it's and I know too. You know when John McCain, picked the governor of Alaska, but Sarah Palin, they sent the Democratic National Party. I was told sent about 75. People to Alaska to try to speak to anyone who had ever known her, encountered her, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What she took out at the library, you know, Blockbuster video, all of those things, trying to find out as much as they could about her in order to discredit her, because she was so extremely popular right away, you know, to the point that I remember Barack Obama was asked something about her and he snapped at the reporter and said, "I'm not running against Sarah Palin. You know, I'm running against John McCain," and they did her in. It was very sad to see, you know, a good family really targeted like that. So, we'll be praying for Judge Barrett and for Judge Peckold and for everyone else who might be under consideration, that God will protect them. And, Professor, I know you have a class that you need to teach in a few minutes, so we will let you go. But thank you again. You've been so generous.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
time.
The opportunity
and again,
to chat with you.
Okay, and listeners can go to Amazon.com to get your book. And again, the title is, please?
Title is What It Means to Be Human, : The Case for the Body in Public Bioethics.
Okay, and by Professor Carter Sneed. Well, it was wonderful to talk to you, Carter. I wish you a very blessed day and a very, very good week.
Thank you. You too. You take care.
Okay, thank you.
Winds of Change invites you to join the Rosary Rally on Saturday, October 10th at 12 noon in front of the outdoor cross at St. Stanislaus Kostka Church. Join us as we join people around the country praying for peace, as Our Lady of Fatima requested. In case of rain, we will meet under the portico outside of St. Stan's School. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. Join us Saturday, October 10th at noon for the Rosary Rally for Peace.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Here is an important message from Winds of Change. The upcoming election could be a turning point for the future of the United States. The pillars of our faith are the sanctity of life and the sanctity of marriage. We can't tell you who to vote for, but we can tell you, as a Catholic, to be registered and to get out and vote your faith.
And welcome. Welcome back. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And thank you for staying through to the second half of our hour today. And I tell you, I have a heavy hitter lineup today. And first, starting with Professor Sneed, and our next guest, Dr. Steve Jacobs, is probably one of the most impressive scholars I think I've had an opportunity to get to know. Dr. Jacobs holds both a JD, a Juris Doctor, which is a law degree, from Northwestern University, one of the top law schools in the country, as well as a PhD from the University of Chicago. So he is no dumb cookie, as they used to say. He is quite an educated and experienced person in talking about law and public policy. And his work, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Doctor, focuses on the intersectionality. So I've always wanted to be able to use that word on my radio show, and I never get to because it's such a liberal word, the intersectionality of law and bioethics and public policy. Did I sum up your work correctly, Professor?
That sounds
Dr.
great.
Good. For having me. Well, gosh, thank you so much for having taking the time, rather, to come on. Okay, so you and I were both on Twitter Friday night, and I think I had to send you a couple of messages to talk me off the ledge because I was I was saddened, frankly, to see some of the vitriol on both sides that was coming out, a little more on the left than on the right, but saddened to see anything that any people who would call themselves pro-lifers were tweeting or were responding to. I understand emotions are very high and certainly can appreciate that. One of the things, and this is why I wanted to have you on, one of the things I kept seeing the most often was people were saying, stock up on, you probably saw them too, because you and I follow the same people, stock up on Plan B and birth control, because if Trump's new justice gets in, it's all over. And I thought, these people are not playing with a full deck, or they're intentionally trying to frighten people and mislead them. So one of the things, of course, you're so involved in advocating for unborn children and your professional work. And I thought you and I could perhaps talk a little bit about what this next justice, if it is someone like Amy Coney Barrett or Martha Packold, as we're all hoping and praying it might be, what will that, practically speaking, mean for Roe versus Wade?
And thanks for having me today. Friday indeed was a surreal evening. As it turned out, I was actually watching Steven Spielberg's film Lincoln when I found out about her passing, and just the enormity of that moment and what it means for the unborn. Here I am watching this film about this great man who stood up for the civil rights, the constitutional rights of a disenfranchised group. And, her passing, while it was, sad in terms of the loss of a human life, it just created a moment where now pro-lifers are looking to the possibility that we, with a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, that we could realize what has been, a minimum of 47-year fight for the constitutional rights of the unborn.
Yes.
And, all those polls from the other side, we'll call it. So these articles have been increasing in recent years where they call on people to stock up on abortifacients and to stock up on, Plan B pill. And it's just really discouraging to see. It's disheartening, especially a lot of the rhetoric. But in terms of how we're going to move forward, I think it's important to call out the fact that we have had very large majorities on the court before. Even if you look at 1992, when we thought that it was our opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and it's not always a guarantee, unfortunately.
No.
And I think we should look back to those moments where we thought, by sole virtue of a Republican president appointing a justice, that we can trust that they would overturn Roe, and that's definitely not the case.
Right, because, and if you could just, explain, I think you and I both as lawyers have an understanding about how a case actually gets to the Supreme Court, and right now, as far as I know, there's nothing sort of currently in the pike that would be a direct facial challenge to Roe. Could you explain to listeners, you know, what that means, that it's not, the court just can't sit down one day and say, we have decided to overturn Roe versus Wade. They need to be presented with a case on which they rule. And, you know, American civics being what it is these days, I was hoping you could perhaps share with listeners a little bit about the process.
Sure. So we're in a state right now where, due to Roe v. Wade, a state is not able to pass an abortion restriction that restricts abortion before viability, before the 24th week of pregnancy.
Right.
So the only way there can be a challenge to Roe v. Wade, the only way that it could be overturned, is if a state passes a law that restricts abortion access at any time before the 24th week. So technically, it could be a pain-capable 20th week ban, and that would be enough that if the Supreme Court agreed to hear it, they could, you know, possibly overturn Roe v. Wade because there is that challenge.
Right.
And the way, so a state passes a law, and then what happens is instantaneously, those in the pro-abortion movement will sue the state on the grounds that that law is unconstitutional, and unfortunately they have standing, which means they have grounds to sue the state, even though they themselves, as abortion clinics or abortion providers, as they call themselves,
right,
even though they are not having their right to have an abortion infringed upon, they have been given standing that they could sue on behalf of the women whose constitutional rights are supposedly being infringed upon.
Right. And so, well, let's just, you know, this is sort of one of the things, you know, you and I both follow each other and support each other on social media, that people, you know, what I have tried to explain, particularly as we're thinking about the upcoming election, right, and what that means for abortion law and abortion policy, one of the things that people frequently disagree with me on is when I talk about how Vice President Biden and Senator Kamala Harris want to codify Roe versus Wade into federal law. And I said, you know, I'll say to people, you know, do you understand what that means? You know, abortion is legal for all 9 months and for any reason, and that includes sex selection abortions. But then people will say, well, look in Pennsylvania. The reason Gosnell's in jail is because, you know, he was performing abortions after 24 weeks, when in reality, Gosnell's in jail because those babies were alive and born before he killed them. So these were born children. These were not abortions. Can you explain how it is that even though some states do restrict post-viability abortions, you know, usually starting at about the 24th week, they still remain legal in our country, something that our current Democratic nominees want to codify in federal law?
Right, and that's why it's a bit misleading when they say that they're trying to codify Roe, and that's what they said in Illinois with the passage of the Reproductive Health Act. So Roe v. Wade, while it does not provide any protections for the unborn, it recognizes that there's a conflict of constitutional rights. There's a conflict of a state's right to protect life and a woman's right to have an abortion, which they recognized in Roe v. Wade.
Right.
Because of that tension, the way the court resolves a collision like that is that when a state has a compelling interest, and one compelling interest is in protecting life, that their right to protect life is greater than a woman's right to choose, a woman's right to have an abortion. And it actually said that in Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
They just deemed that 24 weeks was the point at which a state's right, a state's interest in protecting life was compelling, and that it was more important than a woman's right. And the reason they chose the 24th week was because they didn't know when life began.
Right.
So they weren't able to resolve the question of when life begins. So they used viability as a proxy.
And it was really kind of arbitrary, too, wasn't it?
Very much so. And yeah. I think it's important for people to note that has not been adopted virtually anywhere in the world. There's only a couple of countries that have actually used the viability standard.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 1970s, many predicted that the rest of the world would follow suit and ban abortion at the 24th week and permit it beforehand. But as it's turned out, most countries either have bans at fertilization or at the end of the first trimester.
Okay.
And that's why we have some of the most extreme abortion laws in the country. So when they say it's codifying Roe, all it's really doing, especially what Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have suggested, they actually want abortion access throughout pregnancy, all 40 weeks, and they also want it taxpayer-funded in their attempts to repeal the Hyde Amendment.
Yeah, and that's another, and you know, that's a very sort of interesting and I think risky position they are taking, because even Americans who will self-identify as supporters of legal abortion will say, but it's wrong for, these are private choices, and people, you know, private citizens should not be able, or forced to rather, to pay for other people's private choices.
Right. And for decades, Joe Biden was a proud proponent of the Henry Hyde Amendment.
Right, because it was so popular. I mean, among people of both parties, sure.
Right. It's only in recent years that they've actually tried to, you know, make this full court press to repeal the Hyde Amendment. And I think that just goes to just how extreme the leaders of the Democratic Party have become. So on the left, with the Democratic Party, are that extreme. And that's because if you look at polls, it's still the case that it's typically about 15% of the country believes that abortion should be legal throughout pregnancy.
Right.
But it's actually the case that the large majority of Americans believe, at the very least, it should be restricted at the first trimester.
Yeah. And I think that's where most, and certainly things like sex selection abortions, which, I tell you, I talk about this, and, you know, people act like I'm walking around wearing a little tin hat, as I'm fond of saying. But I remember, in fact, I was at your alma mater. I was at Northwestern's law school to see a presentation by an abortion provider who was from Wisconsin. I think just outside of Milwaukee is where she, or maybe, no, sorry, I take that back, around Madison. She has since passed away, but she was really one of the best known sort of abortionists on the national circuit, because she wrote for the New York Times. It called herself an abortionist, called Why I Am an Abortionist. And I should not be ashamed of that word. But somebody asked her during the Q&A about sex selection abortions. And she kind of laughed and said, you must be a pro, you know, one of those pro-life plant people. And she said, listen, I'll tell you why I do them. And I do them. And they do exist. She was incredible. This woman, I have to say, for all of her, you know, sort of abhorrent viewpoints and practices, was very direct and honest. She said, I serve a Southeast Asian community in our state. And in this Southeast Asian community, women are often abused or not neglected, but you know, could be thrown out of their homes by their husbands if they do not produce a boy, and particularly if they don't produce a boy first. So yes, I do sonograms and ultrasounds to determine the gestational age and sex of the baby, and if they are girls, I will abort them if that's the reason they're aborting them. She said, I've had women on my table, tears running down their eyes, saying, he will beat me to a pulp if I have a girl. I cannot do this. And she said, that's why I do them. And you know, and it was interesting just kind of to watch the, and I thought, well, good for you. At least you said it. And but you could tell that even this was put on by like the Women's Law Society. There was a bit of squirming going on, I have to say, because, you know, these were absolutely, you know, no question. These were healthy, viable, in some cases, you know, on the cusp of viability children.
Right, and I mean, that's the reason why 160 million women are missing from this world.
Right.
So based on sex ratios, we would expect that there should be 1.05 men for every one woman in this world. And if you look at China and India, it actually turns out that, as I said, Mara Vistendahl, she did this research about missing girls from the world, and she found 160 million are missing.
Yeah.
And there was a 2000 study in the 2000s, that found that in the United States, that there actually is a lot of sex selective abortions that take place in that Southeast Asian community. So they had this finding that suggested the sex ratio for third born children, after there were already two girls as the first two children, that the sex ratio was 1.5 to 1,
yeah,
which is absolutely impossible in nature. And that means a significant number of girls were being killed in the womb because of their gender. So the University of Chicago actually did a follow-up study on this, and they did this huge report. It got all this coverage from their law school and their human rights clinic, suggesting that those who make this argument are racist, that it's not real, it doesn't take place, but they buried in their footnotes the fact that they replicated the study that was done in the 2000s, and they found the same result.
Wow.
And they literally buried it in the result. I mean, I couldn't believe it reading through it, that they actually confirmed it. But if you read the report or you read the reporting on the report, they make it out to be that this is just a racist accusation and there's no truth.
Right, right. And that's the thing. You know, I did a little bit of research before coming on, you know, to speak to you today. And it's interesting. They don't deny it. They don't deny it. They just said this is the shaming of mainly shaming of women, Indian women, and women from the rest of Southeast Asia. It is a shaming of their culture and a shaming of their choices. So, you know, here we are, you know, shaming people. It's like the people who tell us that, you know, the reason Connemara Monger died at the hands of Dr. Gosnell is because she couldn't get a second trimester abortion anywhere else. I did one quick Google search. There's a clinic in D.C. maybe an hour away that does them up to 32 weeks. I mean, with, you know, for no fetal indications whatsoever, after 32 weeks, you've got to have a fetal indication, which, as you know, could be anything. It could be a club foot. It could be a club palate. It could be something that is absolutely compatible with life, but simply might require constructive or, you know, cosmetic surgery following. So, well, tell me where, let's do a little bit of prognosticating in the minutes we have left. You and I will have a bet, a dollar bet, you and me, Dr.
Okay.
Steve. Who do you think is going to be President Trump's choice on Friday? I hear he's going to do it either Friday afternoon or Saturday morning.
Right. So, you know, based on his decisions with the last two justices, I think he's going to go conservative. But it is my hope he's going to buck that trend and that he's going to follow through on the reporting. So it had been reported that last year or 2 years ago when Kavanaugh was nominated,
right,
that he wanted to save Amy Coney Barrett
for Ginsburg's
seat. And I think, you know, I haven't had as much time to go through all of the prospective jurists on the shortlist, all of their opinions. But it's my sense at this juncture that Amy Coney Barrett would be the best appointment for, you know, a variety of reasons.
Yeah,
I'll definitely say, as a pro-lifer, I can say that.
Yeah, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Professor Sneed, who was on the show just before you, was her colleague at the Notre Dame's Law School, and he said, you know, Amy is one of these people. She is always the smartest person in the room, but simultaneously always the most humble. And she has seven children, including a child with special needs and including two adopted children from Haiti. So I know that, but the left has had, now that her name has been out there, a lot of time to really, you know, try and dig up anything they possibly can. And Amy will not have an easy time of it. And I'm worried about that for her. My kind of sleeper candidate, this is who I kind of think, I don't know why I my instinct is on this, but is Martha Peckold, who actually is from the Chicago area. She went to St. Ignatius High School and then on a full scholarship to Indiana University and then on to your alma mater, the University of Chicago, where she received her law degree and was the editor of the Law Journal. Devout Catholic, very serious about her faith. So we'll have a dollar bet, okay, for the next time I see you.
And
then we'll just treat each other to a Coke or something if we were both wrong. Well, Dr. Steve Jacobs, thank you again. You're such a great friend of the show. Always good to have you on. And I hope you'll come back again as this battle continues.
Thank you.
All right, God bless you. Listeners, this has been Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony. Goodbye, God bless. Have a beautiful week.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide.